It's kind of self-destructive. So this is someone who is opinionated. He wants things the way he wants them and will use whatever methods have proved successful for him before. Joe Biden's handwriting and signature are highly simplified, so he doesn't t spend a lot of time making his handwriting look beautiful. He's more important with the message than how it's presented. He has very tall capital letters. That would be a sign of pride, someone who is independent and makes his own choices, doesn't want people telling him what to do. Sometimes the writing is a little too simplified, so that can interfere with clear communication. But the simplicity of it means that he can get to the bottom line quickly. He doesn't have to do a lot of talking around it. Pretty firmly grounded in reality, he's a good negotiator, and he would always rather switch than fight whenever possible. So there may not be any surprises in the analysis because, we see a lot of these people in the media. But hopefully it explains the characteristics that we see in the handwriting.
On that note, Sheila Lowe, handwriting expert and mystery writer, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you.
You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. This week, the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously to support the May 31st Gaza ceasefire plan put forth by President Biden, with only Russia abstaining. But before the ink was dry on the UN Security Council Resolution 2735, Israel was already publicly mischaracterizing it. On Monday, Prime Minister Netanyahu's office, which has been consistent in their messaging, saying that, quote, Israel will not end the war until all its conditions are met, that is, fighting until Hamas is eliminated, returning all of our hostages, and ensuring that Gaza never again represents a threat to Israel, end quote. Hamas responded to the UNSC resolution with a clear statement accepting and declaring its readiness to work with mediators on working out the details. Nonetheless, in what has become somewhat routine for U.S. presidents and their cabinet members over decades, Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and their staff members have at every opportunity publicly made the false claim that everyone has agreed to the proposal and that everyone is just waiting for Hamas to agree to the deal. Despite the blatant lies from Blinken, Mitchell Plitnick writes at his Substack blog, Cutting Through, quote, Israel remains obstinate in its determination to sacrifice the remaining hostages for the sake of ensuring Gaza can never again be a security threat, which Plitnick writes is code for destroying the Gaza Strip, making it unlivable in the near term, and pounding it into submission. It's the same brute force strategy that Israel has used since the 1940s, and which, for all the death and destruction it has caused, has only made Israelis less safe, end quote. We are very fortunate to be joined today by Mitchell Plitnick to help us in cutting through the doublespeak around Biden's plan for a Gaza ceasefire, the damage done in repeating the false claim that Hamas is the holdout, the ICC's imperfect request for arrest warrants against two Israeli and three Hamas officials, and the firestorm of support it set off, and more. Mitchell Plitnick is the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy and longtime and frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy. He's the former vice president at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem, and co-director of Jewish Voice for Peace. Mitchell and I currently serve together on the Jewish Voice for Peace Board of Directors. Mitchell Plitnick is also the co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of Except for Palestine, a book about which Ahmed Abu Zinaid, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, wrote, quote, This book explores some of the most fundamental contradictions confronting liberal spaces in the U.S. and makes a powerful case for the progressive core values of humanity, justice, and dignity to finally include the Palestinian people. It is truly my pleasure to welcome Mitchell Plitnik to Middle East in Focus.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for that introduction.
Well-deserved, my friend, well-deserved. Mitchell, as you wrote in your piece titled, "It's Israel, Not Hamas, That Is the Only Thing Stopping a Ceasefire," quote, "There is a worldwide consensus that a ceasefire in Gaza is imperative, with only the most vicious of genocidal racists, largely on the rapidly expanding far right, disagreeing. Can you outline the Biden plan proposal and the differences from the plan that Hamas had agreed to that you highlight in your Mondo Weiss piece that came out yesterday titled, Blinken's Lies About Hamas Rejecting a Ceasefire Reveal the Biden Administration's Plans and the Sticking Points"?
Yeah. So one of the things that Blinken said last week while he was in the Middle East is that this plan that Biden put forward basically is the same plan, according to Blinken, that he said Hamas accepted back on May 6th, which is interesting because at the time, Blinken and the State Department and the White House all insisted that Hamas had not accepted that plan. Now, all of a sudden, they are saying that they did accept the plan. And that this plan is basically the same one. It's actually not. And the ways in which it's different are a little hard to see, but they're really, really important. The basic plan that Biden laid out was that the ceasefire would occur in three phases. In phase one, there would be a ceasefire that would be 6 weeks long. Both sides would completely stop all aggressive actions. And in that time, they would negotiate the terms of a permanent ceasefire. And the permanent ceasefire would happen in phase two. And assuming that it held, at that point, the rest of the living hostages would all be released, with having some of them having been released in phase one in a prisoner exchange for Palestinian prisoners. The rest would be exchanged in phase two, and phase three would be the reconstruction of Gaza and the release of any remains of dead hostages or prisoners held by either side. The key sticking point is in this phase two and in this question of negotiations, because as Biden laid it out, Israel has the prerogative to resume its campaign in Gaza, resume its military activities, its slaughter of Gazan civilians en masse on a daily basis, if it believes that Hamas is not negotiating in good faith. There is no mention in Biden's proposal of what happens if Israel is not negotiating in good faith. This only goes in one direction, and apparently, at least the way it stands right now, the decision as to whether or not Hamas is negotiating in good faith lies in the hands of Israel, possibly the United States as well. Hamas obviously does not want to agree to that. It's a clear trap where they would release many of the hostages in the first phase. They would release all the civilian hostages and only keep those who are military hostages that would be released in phase two. So they would release all the civilians, and then Israel would just start the slaughter all over again. So that certainly is the way it appears. But Hamas is saying essentially, look, we'll agree to the basic framework. This part is not okay. We need to figure out a mechanism so that this decision is not just in Israel's hands. That's why they haven't said, yes, we agree to the full proposal yet. In the May 6th proposal, this is not what was there. What would have happened, that one was also a three-phase proposal, but there was no negotiation process. There was the prisoner exchange in phase one. Assuming both sides didn't violate the ceasefire for 6 weeks, they move on to phase two, which is the release of the rest of the hostages, a full Israeli withdrawal, and the beginning of a reconstruction of Gaza. So that's where the key difference lies. And this is why Hamas is saying, we're not going to agree. It's also why Israel's saying that this plan allows them to fulfill their goals and still get the hostages out. In other words, from what Israel is kind of slyly telling the world is, this agreement will let us get the hostages back and then go back into Gaza and continue what we're doing right now. And if that happens, it would happen with much stronger backing than from the United States than we're even seeing at this point, which is almost hard to conceive of. The protests within Israel would be diminished because so many of the hostages would be home.
Right.
So it's a very, very dangerous proposition. And there's every reason for Hamas to say, look, we will agree to this basic framework, but this part needs to be changed.
Right.
That is a very reasonable position. And it's one, of course, that the United States and Israel are completely rejecting, but they're framing it in a very different way so that they can put the blame for what is going to be the failure of this plan at Hamas's door rather than accept the responsibility themselves.
Right. And can you talk a little bit about the, you know, real harm to people that is done by Biden and Blinken and their subordinates cynically continuing to mislead about the proposal and the negotiations? And I wonder, you know, you've started to lay out what Netanyahu gains by prolonging the assault, but what force, if any, does the UN Security Council resolution have to make a deal, you know, for a deal to finally be reached? Does that put any weight on it?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, the harm to real people is again, in what is really a repulsive bit of Orwellian doublespeak, Blinken and other U.S. officials are haranguing Palestinians and saying, well, you know, that Hamas is rejecting a ceasefire, and every day Hamas rejects the ceasefire, hundreds more people are dying. I mean, this is the worst kind of cynicism. It is, in fact, you know, as I just laid out, it's Israel and the United States that are blocking a ceasefire while trying to make it appear that that at least the United States is pushing for one. These are real people dying every single day. We can just look at Gaza and see everything that we've been talking about for the last 8 months is not just happening. It's happening even more. The things we've been warning about that hadn't happened until very recently, for example, mass starvation. This is starting to happen. We're starting to see now scores of people every day dying from malnutrition and starvation, as we've been warning. So that goes. That adds on top of the people who are dying every day. And it also harms the hostages and their families, the Israeli hostages being held in Gaza. It obviously harms the Palestinians who have been kidnapped by Israel that no one ever talks about and are being held, in literal torture chambers. I mean, we're seeing people emerge from there, half the weight that they were when they went in and just, you know, showing marks of abuse and, which, by the way, we are not seeing with Israeli hostages. And it's a good thing we're not seeing that with Israeli hostages that are coming home, the few that are.
And nor are we hearing our officials talk about that.
I'm sorry?
And nor are we hearing our officials talk about that at all.
No, we're not. We hear the horrible ordeal, and I'm sure it was, that Israeli hostages went through, and I don't think that should be minimized. But right. At the same time, what's happening in literal torture chambers in Israel is not being discussed. And it does seem from all the evidence that we have from both sides that what Palestinians are experiencing in Israeli custody is considerably worse than what Israelis our experience in Gaza, despite the, you know, the horrific conditions that everybody in Gaza, Palestinian or Israeli, is suffering through.
That's right.
So that harm should not be minimized either. And the families who are, you know, don't know every day if their loved ones are still alive. We should not, in any way minimize what the Israeli families are going through. It's a horrible thing.
Right.
And those people are being harmed just as much by Netanyahu, by Biden, by Blinken, by Yoav Gallant, as families are of people in Gaza, even though, of course, you know, again, those people, you know, and those people are actually experiencing the same sorts of conditions. We're hearing from the hostages that are released. What are they scared of? They're not scared of their captors.
Right.
They're scared of the Israeli bombs that are coming, that are the thing that is actually killing the hostages.
That's right.
So all of that should be taken into account, and all of that should be thought about.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK. I'm Esti Chandler. Very happy to be joined today by Mitchell Plitnick, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy and co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of Except for Palestine. KPFK is a listener-supported public radio station, part of the Pacifica Network, which is why you don't hear commercials here. Pacifica is now celebrating our 75th anniversary, a considerable milestone for an independent media network whose idea was born out of a detention camp where conscientious objectors were forcibly detained during World War II. KPFK and the Pacifica Network were created by people who were alarmed by the power that large corporations and governments had in shaping the stories that we are told, which in turn shape public narrative, something we are experiencing in a terrifying way right now regarding nothing more obviously than the vast wave of Zionist McCarthyism sweeping the nation. KPFK and Pacifica took the bold move not to rely on corporations or our government for funding through advertising and underwriting, and instead, for all these years, we've relied on the community that we serve, both by having programmers donate their time and labor to this endeavor and by reaching out to the community we serve to donate whatever they can to keep our shows and the shows that they enjoy and depend on for honest reporting on the air. So I'm asking you now to help us keep going. Help us continue to raise the voices of people like our guest today, Mitchell Plitnick, by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. You can also donate by logging on to kpfk.org and make a donation there. Mitchell, you also wrote recently about the ICC request for arrest warrants for two top Israeli and three top Hamas officials. I wonder if you can talk a bit about that and if you believe that have any idea when or if the arrest warrants might be issued or denied.
So this was the ICC prosecutor requesting arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, as well as Yahya Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, and Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas. There's one thing that I think is the most important thing here, and that is that for the first time, the ICC is actually sending an arrest warrant out for a United States ally. This is a breakthrough. I mean, the biggest complaint about the ICC has always been that the people it goes after are pretty much all African dictators. Certainly people who deserve to be brought to justice, no question about it, but they've always let Westerners off the hook. The precedent was broken a little bit by the arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, in the sense of he was finally a white person that they put an arrest warrant out for. But this is the first time a Western leaders have been under that microscope. So it just the fact that even the requests were made is really, really important. I do think that the prosecutor seemed to go out of his way to try and find as much to charge Hamas with as possible, and missed some stuff that he could have brought against Israel, as well as the crucial point that could have been made that the entire war cabinet, which would have included Benny Gantz, should have been, I think, subject to these arrest warrants. Will they happen? I think that's very much up in the air. It's already, I think, taken longer than I would have expected if the answer was going to be yes. The fact that it has taken this long, I think, reflects the real ugliness of the response to the ICC warrants that came out of both Washington and Jerusalem. This hostility, literal threats that came from Congress, literal threats that came directly from Netanyahu, who basically told the ICC prosecutor to watch his back. It has come out that Israel has been threatening the ICC prosecutors for years to avoid just this scenario happening. So that has been disappointing. I hope the court has the courage to actually issue these warrants. But, as time goes on more and more, I think it becomes less and less likely that they will, although I still think it's a distinct possibility. And it would be devastating if they don't to the concept of international law.
Interesting. About 200 JVP Action supporters were on Capitol Hill recently asking their representatives to call for an offensive weapons embargo on Israel. One of the things that sympathetic congressional offices warned about were the many outrageous and in some cases truly anti-Palestinian amendments being added to the must-passed annual National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, which include Amendment Number 907, which has passed and prohibits U.S. funds from building or rebuilding in the Gaza Strip. And Amendment 1214, which prohibits Department of Defense funds from being used for air transport of Palestinian refugees to the U.S. In your opinion, what is it important for us to stay focused on in regard to the NDAA?
So both the NDAA and the foreign operations bills, these are must-pass bills. And what happens every year is they get renewed and there's all these amendments that get attached to them, particularly in the House. I think on the one hand, it's important to recognize most of these really ugly, racist, horrific anti-Palestinian amendments are not going to pass the Senate. They are almost all entirely Republican amendments, supported only by Republicans. They're not even going to be considered in the Senate version of the bill. They're just going to be wiped out. That being said, we should not ignore them, because what these amendments tell us is what Republicans will do, not might do, but will do if they control Congress and the White House after this November, which is a distinct possibility. Unfortunately, the Democrats have saddled us with Joe Biden, who is literally handing the White House to Donald Trump as we speak. One of the biggest political crimes of this century is the way the Democrats have basically subverted the democratic process in order to make sure that Democratic voters did not have a choice. And we're stuck with this guy who right now is on track to lose to Donald Trump. The issue of voting for Biden, a genocider, is a very, very difficult one. And I can't tell people, certainly people who have a family who are dying in Gaza, to vote for this man. But I can tell people that it's still really important to make sure that Congress does not go over to the Republicans. And this NDAA shows you why, because they will be so monstrous that it will literally be tantamount to the worst words of Nazi Germany directed at Palestinians to the extent that they can. So I think is the really important thing that we can learn from. The NDAA tells us what Republicans not might do, but will do if they control Congress and the White House.
In our last 2 minutes, before I let you go, please tell folks how and where they can read and subscribe to your extremely informative blog, Cutting Through.
So, the Cutting Through blog, it's on Substack. And it is a newsletter, so you get it in your inbox every day. You can get there at Mitchell Plitnik. That's Mitchell with two L's, Plitnick .substack.com. And as soon as you get there, you will see a subscribe button and also the option to become a paid subscriber, which will help me actually expand this and continue doing it and add the various things that I'm hoping to add very, very soon in the next couple of weeks to that. To that newsletter. So if people can help support this sort of journalism, it would really be great.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your weekend to spend with us. You are always one of my go-tos for current information and explanation on the things that are specifically written, as you pointed out today, for us not to understand them. And that's why we depend on you to cut through.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Esty. It's been a pleasure.
In their 2021 book, Except for Palestine, 2021, Mark Lamont Hill and Mitchell Plitnik wrote, quote, "The people of Gaza live in a situation much too precarious to be ignored. The end of the Gaza siege cannot be delayed until the broader question of Israeli occupation is answered. The universal values of compassion, justice, and human rights demand the siege be ended. Disseminating the Gazan's economy and starving the people living there have devastated an already depressed and overcrowded area. Moreover, these actions have not improved the situation for Israelis, Americans, Americans share significantly in the blame for this situation. Our overwhelming silence is a betrayal of the noble, definitive ideals that liberals and progressives profess to hold dear." End quote. Facts are facts, and it is time for them to be reported. Jews in America are rising up to say not in our name more loudly and more clearly than ever, and they're proudly joining the Palestinian movement for their freedom and equality in record numbers. Mitchell Plitnik and I are two of those Jewish Americans, and we both take the responsibility of bringing you the truth very seriously, as Negwa and I try to do here each week by bringing you important voices of writers, artists, activists, and scholars, not only on the international crisis of an ongoing genocide in Gaza, but the emergency of our own government, as we have just heard from Mitchell today. Our public and private institutions are materially supporting this genocide. So I'm asking you to please help us continue to bring you this kind of truthful reporting by making a pledge. And you can do that by calling us now at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Choose number 2. To make a pledge, you can also log on to kpfk.org and make a pledge there. KPFK and Pacifica Network continue to live on the edge. Please do not let us go off that edge and off the air, which, by the way, has happened in the history of this network due to lack of funding. The stakes are simply too high right now. We really cannot allow that to happen again. KPFK is a community-building project, and there are opportunities for our community of listeners, writers, artists, activists, and scholars to get involved, and we invite you all to do that. We have some wonderful thank you gifts for your donations that you can choose from on our website, perhaps none better than a KPFK t-shirt that you can wear to help promote the station and drive the support we need to keep providing the important programs, news, and information we've contributed to this community for 75 years. Once again, please call 818-985-5735 or log on to kpfk.org and make a pledge now. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Mitchell Plitnik, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy and author of the wonderful Substack blog, Cutting Through. I also want to thank Gary Baca for his fantastic production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus. Thank you.
This is Jackson Brown, and you're listening to KPFK, the inspiration station, lifeline to the community, lifeline to the news and the information, the culture that sees us through the year, year after year. I'm asking you to take a moment and make a contribution to the station that keeps your world alive and in tune. The number to call is 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. KPFK has been there my whole life. I don't really know how I would view the world without it.
LA Theater Works airs here on KPFK every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until